This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Welcome to Science in Action from BBC World Service with me, Roland Pease. Later in the programme, a trip to the dawn of complex life and questions about what tipped evolution into top gear.
After that, things took off and got crazy. Not only the diversity, the number of species shoot up very high, but also the turnover rate. Like I said, it's an order of magnitude higher.
And talking of sunrises, NASA's Parker Solar Probe is fast closing in on the sun at hundreds of thousands of kilometres per hour with the aim of swooping through its scorching corona next week.
We kind of liken it to, you know, American football. If you look at one end zone is, you know, Earth and one end zone is the sun, we're going to be on the 4-yard line at this point in close proximity to the sun.
That's to come. New insights into how our skin learns to tolerate and coexist with bacteria on the outside of our body could show a promising way to much easier vaccinations in the future. The normal picture is that our immune system reacts quickly when an infection gets into us, breaking down the virus or bacterium to find the recognisable bits that can be targeted by antibodies or immune cells, a process which can take a few days. The outside of our skin is infested with bacteria like Staphylococcus, which are harmless so long as they are on the outside, but they get deadly if they somehow get in through cuts, for example. What's new is it seems there are parts of our immune system that have already been checking them out to accelerate the response if that happens, and it now seems that vaccines applied as ointments loaded with engineered bacteria could take advantage of that surveillance system. Tests in mice have been encouraging. Microbiologist Jeanette Boosbane has been doing a lot of the hard science.
So it's been shown in the gut, actually, that there are cells that sample inside as if they had like little arms. And it hasn't been shown in the skin, but it seems like maybe something very similar is happening. So basically, the idea is that you're kind of preemptively inducing an immune response against these microbes because they're so close to you that they could, you know, if you get a little nick or cut on your skin, get through the barrier. And so it's better to have basically the immune system ready there to respond in this case.
So it's just it's a readiness. It's a really interesting readiness thing. And if I've read your paper correctly, in the case of these Staphylococcus epidermis bacteria that you've been looking at, there's a particular protein that's sort of sticking out of their surface that's the one that our system's learning to study, or at least the mice that you used in your experiment.
Yeah, so it's this big protein called AAP, or accumulation-associated protein. It's a giant protein that is made of just repeats. And it's kind of fascinating because just the structure in itself is really, really cool. And it has this part of the protein that is very rigid. And you can imagine of it as like a kind of like a paw, like a stick that extends really far away from the surface of the bacteria. It's almost as if you are kind of calling for antibodies to come and bind to it.
How strange. And that's a bit then that our immune system recognizes. And your idea was to tweak the end of it.
Yeah, tweak a little part of it. So if you look at the structure, it kind of gives you ideas about which part would be easy to engineer. I'm not going to go into the details, but one of the portion is kind of big and globular structurally. And so we thought this would be a good place to remove it and then put something else there. We put a fragment of tetanus toxin. It's the non-toxic fragment of the toxin. And it was shown already to be a good antigen, so a good protein to elicit an immune response that would be protective against the toxin.
So you engineer your bacteria by slightly changing this protein on the surface to have this little bit of tetanus. And then you go and put this on mice, is that right?
That's it. Then you just rub it on their skin and the magic happened.
The magic was pretty dramatic, was it?
Yeah, I have to say, we were all kind of surprised. The magnitude of the response is incredible. I think we didn't expect it to be so strong.
So you got an immune... as I understand it, you gave the mice a pretty lethal dose of tetanus, which is a horrible bacterium, and they survived.
Oh, yeah, they were totally fine. So you track them for about 2 weeks and they're totally fine. You just run around like nothing happened.
How extendable is this principle, do you think?
That's a very good question. And this is something that we are working on. One of the things that we really want to be pursuing right now is extending this to viral antigens. And this is a little trickier because viral antigens are very big often, and they're glycosylating, meaning they have little pieces of sugar on them. And the bacteria cannot produce these little pieces of sugar. And so you really need to attach it to the surface of the bacteria without encoding it into the bacteria, meaning the bacteria is not the one producing it.
Yeah, okay. So these are modifications that are made to the proteins after they've been initially produced. And bacteria can't do that, but viruses can. So that's going to be more of a challenge in that case. But nevertheless, a number of questions I have. Is this particular bacteria that you're looking at going to be the really good one? Or is one of the things you're going to do to look for different carriers, shall we say, of the vaccine signal?
That's a very good question. This is, again, something that we are pursuing right now. We know that this works really well with Staph epi, and it seems like, for what we've seen, a lot of Staphylococcus induce similar types of response in mice, in humans, in non-human primates. But the question will be, what is the right one to go in humans? And right now we have something that works really well in mice, but we have to figure out whether this is the right choice for going into non-human primates and eventually humans.
Is that going to require, I mean, obviously you're not going to be giving people lethal doses of tetanus in the future. So I'm wondering, this would start off with, I presume, cell cultures and that kind of thing to try and work out the optimum.
Yeah. So we already have a very good vaccine for tetanus, right? And so that will be harder to test in humans because obviously we already all have immunity against it. But we could be going after some other type of diseases, right? And then you can always take the blood of people and look for the presence of antibodies. And then you can test in vitro if these antibodies neutralize the pathogen.
So you could put something quite safe on the bacterium surface, look for the antibodies, and then you'd know that there was a kind of effect going on without it being a risk to anybody.
Exactly. At least in the first place, definitely. Yeah.
The other thing, it sounds to me like what you're saying is that vaccination could be a lot simpler than it is at the moment if you can bring this idea to maturity.
Well, this is the hope. And I think one other point that we haven't addressed, which I think is quite important, is that a lot of current forms of vaccination really give you what we call systemic immunity. So it's like you have your immune cells circulating in your blood, but you don't really have very good immunity at the site of infection. So let's say for a respiratory disease, you don't have very many antibodies in your nose that protect you from infection. And because these microbes live at these sites, potentially we would be able to induce not only this systemic immunity, but also a local response. And that's what we saw with Staph epi.
So let's say with something like COVID, you could do a version of this that you would effectively just wipe on the nose.
Yeah. Or, you know, what we saw is when we colonized the skin of the mice, we colonized their heads. So it could be that there's incidental colonization of their nose, but we see very good antibody response in their nose as well. Of course, it's pretty early days, right? So there's a lot of some of these questions that you're asking me, I don't have the answers for you. These are things that we need to work on. But even if we had to put a lot of bacteria, it's cheap and you can put it on your skin yourself. You don't need a doctor to do that.
Well, I'm sure some people would like that. Out of interest, is this vaccine work the sideline for you, or is it the host bacteria interaction?
You know, I think I'm more of a fundamental biologist at heart. I found it fascinating. And I think the engineering is fun and the potential application are incredible. But to me, the fact that these response exist and how we are interacting with these microbes that really cover our bodies is what really drives me the most.
Jeanette Boosbane of Stanford University. There are two papers in Nature detailing the microbiology and the vaccine experiments she was talking about. You can find links to those at bbcworldservice.com. By the time the next edition of Science in Action is on air, NASA's Parker Solar Probe will have swooped through the scorching coronal air of the sun, re-emerged and be readying itself to relay back the details of the magnetic fields and particle storms it encountered for just a few hours. It's where the mission has been headed since it was launched in 2018, but ironically, the sun is the hardest place to get to in the solar system despite its massive pull of gravity. Parker has already completed 21 dipping orbits into the corona, with occasional encounters with Venus at the far end of its orbit, each tightening its closest approach just a little. The last was in November, and Parker is now racing inwards for its closest encounter yet. And the good news is the craft and equipment survived all the previous ones, as NASA Heliosciences Deputy Manager Nikki Rail reassured me.
Parker is an engineering marvel. What has had to be designed and to accomplish it, not only on the thermal protection for the heat shield, you know, and also to get us this close, but getting us at, you know, 1400 degrees Celsius at the surface of the heat shield and basically at room temperature for the instruments very close behind that, it's incredible.
And so how close will that be?
So we're within 6 million kilometers of the sun's surface, which is incredible because we're actually in the atmosphere, the corona, or the outermost part of the sun.
And it's going incredibly fast at this point.
Yeah, it is. So we're traveling about 267,000 kilometers per hour.
What I think is so amazing is the preparation for this, because it's just had an encounter with Venus that sort of slowed it up just enough to make this next plunge. I think the precision of the way that you're doing this is amazing.
It is. So to me, like, orbital mechanics are kind of like magic. You know, we're using Venus, which sounds funny, to actually slow us down. It's almost like a reverse slingshot approach where, you know, the mass of Venus is actually slowing us down enough so that Parker can fall a little bit closer to the sun on this pass. And that's what's one of the things that's helping us get to this really close distance to the solar surface.
I mean, it sounds really crazy. I saw that one of your engineers said that the sun's the hardest place in the solar system to get to, which is weird because you think it's where everything's being pulled towards.
Yeah, it is counterintuitive, isn't it? Everything is getting, you know, in some ways, you know, the mass of the sun is just this huge. And you know, when we think about the associated, you know, the pull of that, but it's really, really hard to get there. And how to do these Venus gravity assists, slow us down, get us close, and then, you know, kind of be hovering around and being within that solar atmosphere is an engineering feat. And I sure appreciate those folks who are calculating how we do this.
One other thing is, my head's sort of slightly in a spin itself. We're going around the sun. Venus is going around the sun. The Parker Solar Probe is going around the sun. The sun itself is actually turning on its own axis. When this closest approach actually happens, is it going to be on our side of the sun or on the far side? Because presumably that makes the whole control and of the whole operation pretty complex.
It does. You know, as we go around, you know, from the far side or the Earth side of the sun, you know, on this case, you know, being on the Earth side of the sun in this closest approach, we kind of liken it, and I know the analogy is not great, but to, you know, American football, if you look at one end zone is, you know, Earth and one end zone is the sun, we're going to be on the 4-yard line at this point in close proximity to the sun.
And the idea is that by going through this coronosphere, I think you call it, but this is the outer part, the corona of the sun. You're trying to work out what drives the solar wind, which we've seen quite a lot of this year.
Yeah, you got it. So the corona, or that outer atmosphere, is where we see the start of solar wind, or the start of energy flowing from the sun towards Earth and beyond. And so by being up inside, up close and personal, we're able to see the start of that solar wind to gain a better understanding of, you know, things like, why is it getting hotter? How is it traveling the way it is, accelerating to, you know, half the speed of light? We're also seeing that there's a lot of irregularities or inconsistencies in the corona that we didn't understand until Parker started flying closer, giving us unprecedented information about our star.
And as I understand it, it's all to do with, as it were, the magnetism of the sun interacting and twisting and moving around the plasma that you have in this outer system. So that's the launch mechanism. It's kind of magnetic catapults and so on.
Yeah. So the pole. So there's so much we don't know about the sun, but we do know that, you know, the solar poles switch, and we also know that, you know, it acts like a very hot gas with the plasma moving around. But missions like Parker, and then you know, the other operating missions we have in our fleet, help us to better understand why those things are happening, and most importantly, how those things interact with Earth, our home planet.
And is it going to be, if while Parker is in there for, I don't know how many, is it minutes or hours at its closest approach, are all the other missions and telescopes going to be looking there so that the observations can be combined?
Yeah, so we are on the order of kind of hours transitioning into short day periods with Parker. And the other missions aren't going to turn to look at Parker, but what they will be doing from their unique vantage points is collecting data on the piece of the sun that they're looking at or the sun-Earth interaction that they're looking at. And then we can compare that information to Parker's information, which helps us build out this system-level understanding of our sun.
I mean, is this at this stage of preparation when you're just days beforehand, is there a lot that your team can do, the engineers and so on, to make sure that everything is working? Or basically, are you in the hands of the gods at this moment?
Yeah, so we're very much in the watch and wait and you know, fingers crossed, things are looking good. We certainly monitor the information that's flowing down to indicate the health and status of the spacecraft. And the same thing happens, actually, with this closest pass on December 24th. We're going to have to wait, you know, a few days for us to get the green beacon tone telling us that everything is doing well and everything is successful with that closest yet pass to the sun.
And it's done 21 passes so far. It's survived. Have all the instruments and so on survived pretty well, the previous encounters?
They have, actually. Yes, they have. They're still sending us the data we're anticipating. You know, as we get on these next three closest passes, the first of which coming up, you know, in a few weeks, that's when we're, you know, testing some of the heat shielding and the capabilities of the spacecraft. But we're really confident and pleased with the engineering and science design of this and hopeful we'll get the good science return.
And you mentioned three. So there's another one in March and then another one in June that's planned. And they will basically be on the same kind of orbit. Is that right?
That's correct. It's going to be three kind of similar closest passes to the sun, with the first being on December 24th.
But then it's a blank on the screen that I've got. But I did. I think there are discussions going on about extending the mission to, because it's in such good nick.
Yeah, absolutely. So Parker was originally designed to operate through 2025, and everything is looking quite healthy and well with the spacecraft. And I personally really hope we're going to be seeing data for years to come.
And will it just be left on the same loop, or will there be more maneuvers? Are there other bits of the sun, like the poles, that you could get to?
Yeah, that's a great question. It'll be in a kind of a similar orbits for this spacecraft. We won't be able to do a solar polar mission. Hopefully someday in the future that will be in the cards to discover kind of the unknown poles of the sun. But we'll be doing a similar loop with Parker, closest passes, and then kind of staying in a more stationary orbit out into the future.
So Parker's going to be something to build on.
Absolutely. I think Parker is incredible foundational science, providing that, you know, very close solar wind information, energetic particles and plasma information. And it's an incredible mission that's benefiting the entire portfolio and hopefully designing some science of the future from its results as well.
Nikki Rail at NASA HQ, fingers crossed, though I think actually solid engineering is the more effective guarantee of success. Finally, a trip back half a billion years and some to the dawn of complex life here on Earth. The planet had already been around for 4 billion years, and single-celled bacteria, archaea, even eukaryotes with their DNA safely packaged in a nucleus like in you and me, they've all been drifting around much of that time without doing a lot of evolving. And then, suddenly, a burst of invention, including a load of evolutionary experiments that led nowhere, but which ultimately paved the way for us. Microfossil hunter Shuhai Xiao has been pulling together all the available finds into a single statistical database to get a precise timing on the pulses of innovation and to see how they relate to geological crises of the era, to get an idea of what it was that changed. And though the fossils are rather small, I think that's why Shuhai likes them all.
These fossils don't have any bones or hard skeletons, so they're nothing like dinosaurs. And they're also pretty small, so some of them are just a fraction of a millimeter.
This is a sort of a statistical summation of what you and hosts of other paleontologists have discovered. And it's this period just before the Cambrian era, when modern life exploded about 540 million years ago. You're looking at the build-up. There are whole paroxysms, it seems to me, of creativity going on in life. Is that sort of the nub of what you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. And we're talking about billions of years. So in the Phanerozoic, in the last half billion years, the fossil record is dominated by skeletal fossils. But before that, the most majority of them don't have any hard parts. So can we look at the diversity in the fossil record, just as paleontologists have done for the Phanerozoic in the last billion years? Statistically, this is a much smaller sample. It's just like politicians or political scientists making predictions about elections. They take a small sample and they can have a pretty good guess about the election results. So that's fundamentally what the paleontologists are doing. Not every organism is preserved in the fossil record, but the question is how much we can tell from this small sample about evolution.
You do confirm this idea of a boring billion years, which is where I guess everything was ticking over quite nicely. You have lots of single-celled things which have no particular pressure to evolve. And then suddenly, you know, 700, 600, 500 million years ago, everything changes. And your study really pulls that out.
Yes. So the boring billion has been a little joke for decades. And it was first proposed on the basis of geochemical data. There have been some discussion about whether the biosphere was boring between about almost 2 billion years ago to roughly about 800 million years ago. There's different ways to look at this question. We took the approach of just counting the number of taxa, and it seems to be stable during the boring billion. But that doesn't necessarily mean that evolution is static. So it could be the overall diversity maintained the same, but the turnover rate is very rapid. You just maintain an equilibrium. So species come and go, but the total number of species may be maintained at the same level. But what our study shows is that not only the total diversity maintained static, but also the turnover rate is very low. So that further confirms the sort of static nature of evolution in the boring billion.
I mean, for someone who's listening to this and can't see the graphs that you have in your paper, how dramatic is the transformation?
It's many factors of difference. It's an order of magnitude in difference before and after the global glaciations or the global ice ages. So the divide is marked by a couple of very serious major ice ages that happened 635 million years ago to 720 million years ago.
These are so-called snowball Earth episodes.
Yes, exactly. After that, things took off and got crazy. Not only the diversity, the number of species shoot up very high, but also the turnover rate. Like I said, it's an order of magnitude higher.
So this is species coming and going. They evolve and then they go extinct and they're replaced.
Exactly. There's a almost like coordinated radiation and a coordinated disappearance or extinction.
What I'm sort of wondering is to what extent are the organisms that you're looking at in here the prelude, as it were, to modern life? And to what extent does that explain what happened subsequently in the next half billion years?
Some of them are definitely, one can think it's precursors of Cambrian and the later organisms. But I think the most majority of them are sort of the side branch. So we're focusing on a much larger group of organisms, and only a small fraction of them led to the Cambrian animals and the later organisms.
And are these the kinds of things that this kind of statistical analysis, where you lay your evolutionary stuff alongside the geochemical messages, is that where you start to see, okay, it could be this or it could be that? In a funny way, I'm sort of wondering, was it the Earth that made it happen? Was it geology that made it happen? Or was it that biology got to a point where it could suddenly change and it helped transform the planet?
Those are really good questions. I think in general, almost in all cases, it's both. So biology does not exist in a vacuum, and geology has to work with biology in order to have an impact on the biosphere. Oxygen is made by organisms, so that's biology. But making oxygen alone does not necessarily result in more oxygen in the atmosphere, because the oxygen the organism made would be consumed by the degradation of the organism when it dies. So geology then step in, you bury the organic carbon, the dead organism, and that's basically the cores, the oil and shale gas and all this stuff that is stashed in the rock record for billions of years. So that allows oxygen to be accumulated in the atmosphere, allows the increase of oxygen levels. So this is a perfect example to show that the biosphere and the geological process work together to make something happen.
One other question on the rate of turnover, because this is a graph you have as it were, on the covering page of the paper. It looks like you get this enormous leap of invention going on at about 600 million years ago, and then an absolutely massive one 540 million years ago, which I guess is the Cambrian explosion. Since then, have we maintained that rate of invention, or was the Cambrian explosion the time when life was most exciting?
If you look at the basic architecture of animals, then the Cambrian explosion is the most exciting event, because that's when all these basic fundamental architectures of animals appeared. In Ordovician and in the Mesozoic, you know, dinosaur times, for example, Cretaceous, there are a lot more species than in the Cambrian time. But still, we're looking at the same number of basic animal architectures. So in that sense, the Cambrian explosion is fundamentally the most exciting event.
Zhuhai Xiao of Virginia Tech, the new timeline was shared in the journal Science. And before we wind up, it's 5 years since the first cases of a worrying unknown pneumonia were showing up in Wuhan hospitals. The world didn't learn about them until the last day of 2019, but COVID-19 became the defining crisis of the next 2 years, and it still haunts us. I think it's been forgotten how much science of preceding years forearmed us to handle the pandemic, though there were mistakes too. I also worry, though, that the trauma of it all has blinded us to the lessons we need to retain ahead of the next outbreak. So, the next two episodes of Science in Action will address the lessons of COVID-19.
We started working immediately when we heard about the whole development in China. So that was around New Year's.
I hope you'll join us. Till then, from me, Roland Pease, and producer Alex Mansfield, thanks for listening.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.